Today, it's great to chat with Christian Jarrett on the podcast. A cognitive neuroscientist by training, Christian is deputy editor of Psyche, a global digital magazine that illuminates the human condition. Christian has written about psychology and neuroscience for publications across the world, including BBC Future, Wired, New York Magazine, New Scientist, GQ Italia, and The Guardian. He was the founding editor and creator of the British Psychological Society's Research Digest, presenter of their PsychCrunch podcast, and an award-winning journalist on The Psychologist magazine. His books include The Rough Guide to Psychology and Great Myths of the Brain. His most recent book is called Be Who You Want, Unlocking the Science of Personality Change. Christian, so nice to finally meet you and talk to you.
You too, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Talk to you on the podcast, I should say. We've talked on Twitter DMs.
We have, yeah. And I think I wrote for you many years ago when you launched the Creativity Post.
Wow, that was a lifetime ago.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so we go right back.
We do. So is it true that I can be who I want?
I think within reason, you can definitely become a better version of yourself, and you can change yourself in ways to help you live according to your values and what matters to you most in life.
Okay, so that was my cheeky question, but I want to back up to your childhood for a second. You said that when you were a child, you were characterized as too quiet by your teachers when you were a teenager. Is that right? So how did you burst out of the shell when you started university?
Yeah, my teacher reports when I was at school, they all basically said the same thing, that I don't talk enough and I'm hiding in the shadows and trying to get me to contribute more. Which I think was true to an extent. When I went to university, well, I think one thing is some of the crowd that I fell in with. I made good friends from the beginning with a real out and out extrovert. And I think that speaks to the fact that one of the strongest influences on our personalities is the people that we mix with. I think my own goals changed. I wanted to have fun when I arrived at university, and the whole milieu there was encouraged a more sociable lifestyle. But I think the fact that I was so influenced by some of the friends I had is consistent with some theory, and findings in the psych research, that our personalities are to a large degree affected by our relationships, and the personalities of our friends and so on rub off on us. And also the kind of the kind of role you play in your friendship group. I think if you're caricatured a certain way, especially in a way that you don't like. I mean, it can almost make you start to play a certain role and live up to a certain reputation. So I think when I started university, I had a whole new set of friends, a new environment, and that helped me do what I wanted to do, which was be more outgoing, be more gregarious. And yeah, that's how I managed it at that time. A little bit of alcohol probably helped as well.
It does. And also living in England, this happened to me too. I broke out of my shell when I was in England. And I was about 25 on a scholarship to Cambridge, just to drop that there. I went wild. I became friends with this big punk rocker looking English British extrovert, and we'd go out all the time, and I was like, wow, I can do this, but it didn't last too long. I feel like my introverted tendencies kept coming back. But look, let me ask you something, about the biological aspect of this, in the research that you did for this book, what role did you find for biology and temperament?
Yeah, well, personality definitely gets beneath the skin, as they say. So I think often personality can seem very abstract. Like, is it a real thing or is it just a description? And there are quite a few findings coming out now on the neuroscience of personality is a real burgeoning area. So,
it's true.
Yeah, strong introverts, their brains will, if you scan their brains in a brain scanner, you'll find their brains really are more sensitive to stimulation, for example. If you compare like high scorers in neuroticism who suffer, you know, who experience highs and lows of emotion compared with someone low on neuroticism, who's very emotionally stable. Even down to the level of the myelination of nerve fibers, you kind of see these differences between these groups. Even things like gut bacteria, like people high in neuroticism tend to have more so-called bad bacteria in their guts. Things like that, biological markers of inflammation are higher in people lower in conscientiousness, people higher in neuroticism. So, you know, whether it's brain activity or brain structure or your inflammation in your body or your gut bacteria, all these different levels, you've got personality manifesting at these different levels.
Yeah, for sure. How did you come across my colleague Colin DeYoung's work at all?
It doesn't ring a bell. What she found?
His name's Colin, and Colin DeYoung really leading the charge in the field of personality.
Oh,
neuroscience.
DeYoung, yeah. So. I have DeYoung. I think I cite his work in the book.
Oh, nice! I'll have to tell him. I'm actually talking to him today for the podcast.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah, I think he did a neat review of the kind of neuroscience of personality. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was in that lab in grad school. That was the lab I was in, and he was the postdoc in the lab. Yeah, really, really awesome guy. Deserves a lot of credit. So there's lots of, you know, unpacking the mysteries of personality science is, it's like, well, there's so many different entryways, you know. So we just discussed biology a little bit in the fact that biology doesn't make destiny, though, right? I think that's important to point out, too. You know, this nurse, yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, the biology of personality, one thing it points to is how important our health and kind of sport behaviors are. If you want to change your personality for the better. It might not seem directly related to personality, but by working on your physical health, you can actually benefit your personality.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. Do you work on your physical health?
If anything, I'm probably a little bit prone to, being a bit addicted to. I'm one of those people who doesn't like it, you know, if I miss the chance. So yeah, I'm guilty of one of the annoying people who have joined the Peloton family.
I've thought about that. I've thought about that Peloton world. Okay, so there are a lot of things that can influence personality. What about the whole research literature on changing roles? Like if you go to a new job or you change your identity, you know, your work identity changes. That could be one thing, right?
Definitely, yeah. That's one of the sort of strongest theories in the personality change literature and better supported theories, I would say. Yeah, social investment theory, I think they call it. So yeah, the jobs, the roles we take on in life do shape us. We get feedback on how we're expected to behave. And so yeah, if you begin a new job, especially I think if you find it rewarding and you enjoy it and you're given clear feedback on what is expected of you, I think you're bound to see increase in trait conscientiousness. And that's what you see with graduates when they get their first jobs, their conscientiousness typically increases. After a job promotion, you tend to see people get an increase in trait conscientiousness. And I mean, more extreme examples would be things like people who go into special forces training or military training. You know, then you get to see even sharper increases and maybe lower neuroticism, that kind of thing. So. At what leadership positions, again, you get these kind of changes. So yeah, definitely. I think it doesn't have to be work, of course, but I think the roles that we take on in life, because they demand certain things of us, and if we are motivated and we're rewarded for certain kinds of behavior, because a lot of personality is ultimately built on the habits of our thinking and our emotions and our behavior. If we are rewarded for behaving in certain ways over a period of time, it's going to shape us over time. Ultimately changing our personalities. Yeah.
But didn't the behavioral genetics research kind of change our ideas about what exactly has the biggest influence on our on personality differences as we age. Like, you know, Judith Rich Harris's book was seminal in saying, well, our peers, you know, have a lot more influence than our parents. That's what she said. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, of course, there's a whole industry built around, you know, how to parent, how to be a good parent, and it can be very anxiety provoking for parents. And yeah, the research, a lot of it suggests parents' influence on their kids' personality, besides what they hand down in their genes, is relatively modest. Exactly as you say, it seems to be unique experiences outside the home, including peer influences, which have more of an influence. So I don't think that's to say, obviously, parenting is irrelevant, but I think it's more, it comes down to more like, are you an authoritative parent? Are you warm and encouraging and consistent? That will be beneficial to your child's personality versus are you authoritarian? Are you cold and distant? Inconsistent, you know, and I think those two broad things you could say that the warmer, encouraging style is beneficial for a child's personality, and the cold, distant, inconsistent is harmful. But beyond that, yeah, I don't think parents kind of can, for a second, kind of deliberately sculpt their kids to have certain kind of personalities. And I've seen for myself. I have 7-year-old twins. And I've seen for myself the limits of parental influence. It's amazing to see what children bring to the equation in their own, obviously their own genetic endowment, that what personality dispositions and proclivities they have that they start out with.
But if things are too extreme, you really can mess them up, right? Like what's the research on divorce, and that effect on personality?
Yeah, so when I say the influence of parents is relatively modest, yeah, obviously extremes of, neglect and abuse and that kind of thing is going to have, no question, harmful impact, especially on, as you know, on, for example, attachment, a person's attachment through their life. Divorce, I don't think there's like a specific consistent outcome. It will depend on how well the parents navigate their separation and how supportive they are of the kids and so on. So I don't think parents should agonize about that too much, but more extreme forms of maltreatment for children, unfortunately, can lead, especially, yeah, to attachment problems. And as I say, you know, children bring their own side to the equation. So I'm sure you'll have heard of the concept of orchid children. So there are probably a minority of kids will be extra sensitive to a difficult upbringing, difficult circumstances. The majority of so-called dandelion kids will fare better in difficult circumstances. They'll be relatively impervious whether things are incredibly good or terribly bad, whereas the orchid kids, their personalities and their mental health will suffer more in bad times. But if they have a supportive, loving, nourishing upbringing, they will thrive even more than the dandelion kids. So you get these it's an interaction between one's genetics and environment through upbringing. It's the two, as you know, interacting with one another.
Is that true though? Because is that true among dandelions though? You just said there are some that, regardless of the environment, tend to be really upright and not affected as much. So
within reason, I think.
Yeah, so maybe there's the whole point there, I think, was really cool. A good point. There's individual differences in the extent to which genes and environment interact.
Yeah, that's right. So, in the sense that if your genetic disposition inclines you to orchid kind of phenotype, yeah, then then the environment is, you're more sensitive to the environment.
Right.
Yeah,
but then but then the dandelion is not as, there's more of an inner core there. So I think, there's even just more nuance than just kind of like the usual saying, like, well, of course, environment and genes interact, which they do, you know, but I think what you pointed out is even more interesting, though, is that there's individual differences in the extent to which they interact.
It's not the same for all of us. Yeah, the role of the environment is more important for some than others. And we tend to talk about it in terms of children, but of course it lasts through life.
Yeah. Yeah. And another really interesting part of that research is that the very same environment that if you have the kind of temperament where you can be swayed very easily, if you are raised in a very malnourished environment, you're more likely to develop anxiety like traits. But if you grow up in a supportive environment, you're more likely to develop curiosity and exploration like traits. So that's pretty important, you know, findings there. You know, I'm sure you read the summer camp study on that, finding that these kids, depending on their genotype, depending on how they were raised and treated, you know, it could go in two very different directions.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's so important because it's a reminder that people aren't, you know, they're not stuck. Their personality isn't sort of one permanent thing. It can be channeled in different directions depending on their experiences in life and how supported or not they are. And obviously, as we get older, we can start to be more intentional about that for ourselves.
Yeah. So are there happy events in life that don't necessarily translate to positive effects on personality?
Yeah, well, we've been speaking about parenthood, so one that springs to mind immediately, is so that whole social investment theory to do with the roles we take on shaping us in a beneficial way. You would think becoming a parent with all the demands that entails would be like the perfect training camp for trait conscientiousness. But if anything, the research seems to show it goes off the cliff. You know, parents' personalities tend to, in some ways, you could say, suffer in the immediate aftermath of parenthood. Self-esteem, there's this research with mothers suggests self-esteem goes down, neuroticism goes up, conscientiousness goes down, all this kind of stuff. So it's a joyful, happy time, but is obviously not easy. And I don't think there's a clear explanation in the literature. My own take on it would be that the social investment theory research is based on when you have a role where the demands on you are very clear of what is expected of you, and you get these kind of rewards for behaving in the ways expected of you. I think with parenthood, it's just such a messy, overwhelming time. It's too confusing and chaotic, and it's not clear what's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. Plus, factor in sleep deprivation and such a radical change in lifestyle and freedom and all these things. I don't think if you pause and think about it, it's not so surprising that it comes with these at least short-lived challenges for personality. Yeah.
Well, what about dandelions? Do they deal with it better?
Dandelion parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something I don't think anyone's looked at that. Like, as
no.
far as I know.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Like, what is a orchid child? What kind of parent do they become? Or
I know. I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you would imagine a dandelion parent would maybe cope better, or they'd be more, show more trait stability, maybe, whereas maybe an orchid parent would, depending on how things are going, show more more variation. Of course, parenting is very different for different people, depending on their own circumstances, you know, whether they're juggling work or not, and whether they have support, you know, you have a supportive partner or not. And of course, some children, although we all want to think our kids are bundles of joy, some kids are more of a challenge to raise than others as well.
Well, you know, but there's a strong genetic component there. So the difficult children, you're probably a difficult parent.
Absolutely.
And then there's an interaction. So the two end up being very difficult with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's why I think, yeah, you can get some difficult child-parent dynamics unfolding for sure. I think, yeah, you know, high trait neuroticism, it's going to be handed down. And then, yeah, you can have all sorts of fireworks.
What is the lemon juice personality test?
Well, this goes back to Hans Eysenck. And, you know, he had this theory that the key difference between introverts and extroverts is to do with their how sensitive they are to stimulation. So the lemon juice personality test is you use a Q-tip. And you put you hang it from a thread, and you put lemon juice on one side, and you put the plain side in your mouth for a short time. Switch it around, put the lemon juice side in your mouth for a short time, and then dangle the Q-tip and see how evenly balanced it is. And the idea is, introverts, being much more sensitive to stimulation, they salivate a lot more in response to the lemon juice, which makes that side heavier. So the idea being, if you're an introvert, the lemon juice side of the Q-tip will dangle down lower. By the way, I've tried this in a talk on personality in a London bar, and it was a disaster.
It didn't work out.
I mean, if I thought about it more carefully, I should have known. I mean, imagine people don't want to put a Q-tip in their mouth in public and start mucking about. There are issues, even pre-pandemic, there are issues of cleanliness, understandably, and all that kind of stuff. People don't particularly want to muck about with putting things in their mouth and dangling from threads and things. So, yeah, it didn't go too well. It became more a test, I think, of extroversion, probably, who was willing no, it's meant to be a test of extroversion. I mean, maybe more a test of conscientiousness, you know, how squeamish. Yeah, like how squeamish people were.
You know, Hans Eysenck is a bit of a controversial figure now. A lot of his work has been found to not, replicate. I think he had abhorrent views on certain issues, but anyway, it doesn't mean no one's all good and no one's all bad is what I like to say. That's true.
It's a bit of fun, really. I don't think it's I wouldn't take the lemon juice test very seriously.
It's not a controversy, as you would say. It's not this one. The lemon juice test is not a catastrophe. It's one of his least controversial things. You know, this whole idea of cancel culture, right? That like we should cancel people who because they've done something stupid at one point in their life, or, you know, we dig up something they did in high school and it's like, as a 50-year-old, cancel them. Now, how does that kind of mentality dovetail with your research on personality change and the idea that maybe people can actually grow over their life?
Well, the research and thesis that I put forward in my book is directly against cancel culture, I would say, because I suppose I would be all in favor of giving people a second chance. So I profile various public figures in the book who had, you know, real lows in life or did bad things in their life, and who managed to turn themselves around and change their personalities for the better. One would be, for example, Majid Nawaz, who does remain a controversial figure, but, you know, he was a one-time extremist, Islamist, you know, in favor of killing homosexuals and, He went around with a knife as a teenager with a knife strapped to his back. He ended up jailed for trying to foment terrorism and what have you. He had this experience in jail where he educated himself intensely. He read widely. He kind of changed his values and goals in life, and he became that same. You could maybe call it, you know, extreme extroversion and almost obsessive drive that he had. He channeled it into being a force for promoting peace and tolerance. So he co-founded the world's first kind of counter-extremism organization. Well, he's a person. I mean, they may well still be people who would like to cancel him, but you could say if he'd been cancelled as a very young man, then the world would never have benefited from his peace work. But of course, there are less extreme examples than that. And yeah, so I would, and everyone makes mistakes. We all make mistakes. And we all have the potential to grow and improve ourselves and become better versions of ourselves. So unfortunately, the cancel culture is, anathema to all that.
Thanks for not canceling me for fumbling your bio.
I was tempted.
I know. I saw you. What do I want to talk about next? Well, here's something that a topic that I'd like to discuss. You know, what about people with personality disorders? Don't they have unique challenges in trying to change their personalities?
Yeah, they do. So, well, for a long time, personality disorders were considered untreatable. It was almost part of the definition. So, yeah, narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder. There are quite a lot of them. Antisocial personality disorder. Yeah. So it's been a controversial area in psychiatry and clinical psychology, actually, for a number of years over whether such people can be helped or can help themselves or can change themselves. There is, I think, I looked at the whole literature and I think there's growing evidence that even, yes, these people who have particularly problematic personalities can be helped and can help themselves. There are ways.
But what are the new challenges? Like for instance, if you have narcissistic personality disorder and you think there's nothing that needs to be changed, let's say you think you're perfect. You think that you're the best. You're winning. Why would you want to change if you're winning? But let's say you're wreaking havoc everywhere you go. What do you do with that person? Or how does that, what's going on there?
Yeah, there are unique challenges with such people. And I have to say, intentional, deliberate personality change is always going to be so much harder, if not impossible, if a person does not want to change. It almost goes without saying. So you're quite right. If someone does not have insight into there being anything wrong, that is such a huge hurdle to get over in the first place. I think there are the question of insight, in different personality disorders and mental health problems in general is a fascinating one. I think there are some people with personality disorders who will have a degree of insight, and so you can build on that. You can work on that and build on that. There will be people with narcissistic personality disorder, for example. I'm not saying all of them by any means, but especially over time, they might come to see that their way of relating to others and the world is harming them over time. Actually, they will experience more stress, in their life, stressful events than average. They will see that they might thrive early in their social relationships. That tends to be the pattern. We tend to like narcissists early on. They make a splash at the beginning. Yeah. and then we tire of them very quickly. And, some narcissistic people who score high in narcissism will recognize that over time, and they might want help, and they can be helped. besides that, without insight, you know, there are some devious ways to try and work with people with narcissism or psychopathy, because you can try and play things to their motivation. You know, you could try and show them that it's in their interest, for example, to work on certain skills, that such as their empathy, for example. And if you can show them that by increasing their empathy for others, they will be more successful, you know, in their goals, even though they're remaining kind of selfish, you can sneak under the radar. You can sneak things like empathy training and so on to them, which of course, if things like the empathy training is successful, it will help lower narcissism and psychopathy, for example. So that there's a way of framing the interventions in a more tantalizing way for people who are more self-interested and self-centered.
That's somewhat hopeful. So are there U.S. presidents that are U.S. presidents in general more likely to display psychopathic traits? And if so, why?
Yeah, there is evidence to suggest they are, especially a subtrait of psychopathy called fearless dominance. Mm. There is. So that's the kind of, it's a trait that's also found at high levels in, for example, surgeons and special forces operatives and that kind of thing. So the one way of looking at it is as extremely low neuroticism, like almost unnerving levels of emotional stability. So you can see why it might be beneficial to a president or a surgeon who has to make life or death decisions, or in the case of a president, obviously make decisions that are going to affect millions of people. In a case of a surgeon, you know, slicing with a scalpel into someone's body, and so it's the subtrait or facet of psychopathy that is probably most associated with what some researchers call like successful psychopathy or success. They talk about so-called successful psychopaths.
I mean, any of these traits in isolation of the others are not the whole. Right. I mean, like you can score high. Let's say the only facet of psychopathy you score high in is fearless dominance. It doesn't mean you score high in psychopathy, right? It just means you score high in fearless dominance.
I guess on average, if you took a large sample of people, you would expect the fearless dominance to correlate with the other subtraits as well.
My surgeon isn't a psychopath. I hope my surgeon just scores high in fearless dominance, coupled with compassion.
That would be the ideal. Yeah. There was a journal paper looking at psychopathy in surgeons suggesting it is higher than average in surgeons, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And
holy cow.
CEOs, you know, psychopathy is supposedly on average higher among CEOs, and but yeah, if you break it down into these subtraits, yeah, the idea would be that you don't score uniformly across all the different subtraits, but you could, in theory, you have some individuals who have a profile where they're high on the fearless dominance and not so high on the less favorable subtraits. But I mean, some of this is controversial. I know you all know this. You know, people argue about how finely we can break down these different traits, you know, and how much it makes sense to talk about subtraits or not, and what have you. You know, some people are skeptical about the dark triad at all.
They're skeptical of the dark triad.
Yeah.
Have they never met an asshole before?
Well, I think they would lump it into like low agreeability, for example. They would, you know, collapse it into the big five. Some people who.
Well, more, you mean that more likely collapse into the hexaco honest humility factor.
Yeah, well, that's the, yeah, for those who favor the sixth, yeah, the bit sort of the sixth trait. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, what is a challenge mindset versus a threat mindset?
Oh, well, a challenge mindset is, this pertains to when you, have an event ahead of you, that you're fretting about, that is, very demanding. So it could be a sports event, giving a public speech, doing a podcast interview, whatever it might be. And a challenge mindset is, if you have a challenge mindset, you see it as within your abilities, within your you believe your capabilities exceed what is going to be demanded of you. You see it as a learning experience. You see it in terms of what you're going to get out of the experience. A threat mindset is like the reverse of all those. So threat mindset, you worry that you don't have the skills and abilities to cope. You worry about what the bad things that are going to happen to you out of this situation. You know, all that can go wrong. That would be the threat mindset. So I encountered this way of looking at things in the realm of sports psychology. I think that's where it originates. I'm not sure. So a sports psychologist might work with an athlete to try and encourage them to have a challenge mindset when they have an event coming up versus a threat mindset. And there are various things you can do to try and encourage yourself to have one mindset or another. For example, in keeping the sports context, athletes, for example, can perform certain rituals before an event to help them feeling, you know, somewhat familiar and in control, so that they're not feeling fearful, to encourage those feelings of confidence and that they can cope. And obviously a sports psychologist can coach an athlete to try and see it as a, you know, a learning opportunity rather than seeing it as, you know, what am I going to lose today in this race? You know, what's going to go wrong for me today in this race or this, to giving this speech or whatever it might be. You can think, well, what am I going to learn? You know, what am I going to learn? I'm going to grow from this experience rather than suffer from it. And yeah, I mention it in my book because I think, for example, I think extroverts are probably inclined more to see things as a challenge than a threat. They're more optimistic by nature. So they naturally see things as a chance that, you know, they're hungry for reward and they see things as a opportunity for reward and pleasure. They go seeking that out and they're willing to take risks. And I suppose for those of us with more introverted inclinations, I see the challenge versus threat mindset as a way of maybe trying to come out of your shell a little bit, trying to be a bit more willing to take risks and have a more positive, optimistic attitude towards opportunities that come your way in life.
I mean, clearly neuroticism plays a huge role and it's strongly correlated with the threat mindset.
Yeah, exactly. So you got where extroverts are drawn to reward, yeah. You've got neurotic people are very sensitive to and fearful of punishment, yeah, and things going badly, yeah.
But there are two different dimensions. So you can get cases like me, where I'm a neurotic extrovert.
Yeah, you can. I know, and I think that's probably not recognized enough.
No, it's the personality interactions that are much more interesting to me than any of these one dimensions in context of the others, or devoid of context of the others. I actually wrote an article for Scientific American called "Confessions of a Neurotic Extrovert."
So, did you?
Yeah. Yeah. The motto of neurotic extroverts is act first and then worry immediately.
I like that. Yeah, I sometimes wonder if I'm, yeah, like, rather than being an introvert, like maybe I'm a kind of a neurotic narcissist or something, you know, like
yeah. A vulnerable narcissist. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'd really like to have more attention and be out there more, but I'm just, yeah, my neuroticism is too high and I find it too scary.
I write a lot about vulnerable narcissism, and which is mostly a disorder of neuroticism. It really is. Yeah. I think a lot of people, like I wrote about that in my book Transcend. I had a checklist for vulnerable narcissism. A lot of people were like emailing me, being like, "That's me."
Yeah.
So, well, I think we're all. There's something fundamentally human about these, all of these personality traits. I think it's important to recognize that they're all continuums, and we all lie somewhere on these continuums. So we can at least identify moments when we've been introverted, moments we've been extroverted, moments we've been bold psychopaths, and moments we've been, you know, less bold, you know, moments when we've been conscientious. So we're just talking about density distributions, right?
Yeah, and actually, I remember you describe it in those terms in your book, Transcend. Yeah, I really like that way of looking at it, because, as you say, it's like we all have these little, rather than seeing ourselves as one type, we have all the different types within us, but we just vary in how often we express them, you know. And yeah. I think part of intentional personality change is it can be a question of just shifting those distributions. It doesn't have to be a profound change, you know, from one extreme to the other, from black to white. You know, it can be just shifting the distributions a little bit. Could have, I think, massive consequences for your life. So, I mean, that's one way I've looked at it with myself, is trying to, for example, increase my willingness to take risks. So to be an extrovert, to be that kind of low neuroticism extrovert a little bit more often. And who knows if that makes the difference between you having the willingness to go up to someone, you know, at a networking event, or if it makes the difference to you accepting an invitation one day that you might not have done if you hadn't been working on your personality development. I think the consequences could be meaningful, even with quite subtle shifts, as you put it, in that kind of distribution of your behavior profile, you know, in life.
Okay. Maybe that's a good place to end this episode today. What do you think? Did that feel, that felt good? Christian, I really appreciate you writing this book and just shining a spotlight on the fact that personality change is possible, not unlimited, like some self-help gurus claim, but within the realm of science, scientific parameters, still shining an important spotlight on this topic. And I wish you all the best in this book tour.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Scott. And, you know, my book, it's, you know, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants in the sense that, you know, I'm drawing on the work of personality psychologists and researchers like yourself, and you're one of them. And so I'm really grateful for all the work you've done, and I'm really grateful to talk to you today.
Thanks, Christian.